We're also joined by Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, everyone.
Congressman Cicilline, we've seen in the presidential race how both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have touched a chord with American voters concerned about the economy and globalization. How do you respond to people who question whether the benefits of trade are not worth the disadvantages of losing manufacturing jobs to China and other countries?
No, I think you're right. I think both Senator Sanders and Donald Trump have spoken a lot about trade and about the harm that trade has done to American workers and American jobs. And I think they're both making the same point, that trade is important, but that we have to have good trade. We have trade policies that are fair and free, that protect American workers. And you can have trade deals. Look, we want trade, but we want trade deals that work for America, work for our economy, and work for American workers. And that means you have to have provisions that deal with the issues of currency manipulation, that have labor standards and environmental standards that are enforceable. If you have that, you can have trade policies that work. Unfortunately, I think we've had a number of trade policies that don't have those provisions that are enforceable. And as a result, it's beneficial to people at the top, to the giants of industry, but not necessarily beneficial to wages or workers. And I think people understand that. They see what NAFTA did to Rhode Island, what NAFTA did to manufacturing in this country. And I think people have a right to be very reluctant about trade deals, and they should be, unless we can be confident that they actually protect American workers.
And it was a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, who supported NAFTA. So what's the political answer for those Rhode Islanders who feel as if they're being left behind by the economy?
Well, I mean, the political answer is to fight, to support candidates who are committed to fixing what's wrong with our economy and with our trade policy. You know, people have a sense, and they're right, that this economy is rigged against hardworking Americans, you know, middle-class families, that we have, you know, trade policies that don't work, that people pay too much for prescription drugs, they can't afford to send their kids to school. We have a tax code that gives hedge fund managers a lower tax rate than their secretaries. We have a tax code that gives billions in subsidies to big oil, that gives tax benefits to companies that ship jobs overseas at the expense of jobs here. The question now is, who's committed to a set of policies to fix these things? We have a number of proposals on the Democratic side that address every one of the issues I just mentioned. We need to take back the House, have a Democrat in the White House, so we can move these policies forward.
Let's go to Scott.
Why do you think Bernie Sanders did so well in the Rhode Island primary, despite Hillary Clinton having all of the backing of the state hierarchical politicians, the top Democrats, including yourself?
I think for exactly the reason I just described, I think his message really speaking to the corrupt campaign finance system, of the necessity of fixing that and what an impediment that is to fixing everything else we need to fix. He's absolutely right about that. He's spoken about it a lot. I think that he's the economic inequality that exists in this country, which people in Rhode Island particularly feel, was very powerful. He obviously had a very well-organized campaign with people who not only said they were supporting, but really worked for him. I think, you know, in my district, where it was, you know, sort of more evenly split. But I think, you know, Bernie Sanders got people very excited. He was speaking about issues that need to be addressed. And I think we make a big mistake as Democrats if we don't embrace those issues as we have in the House, at least the House Democrats, and continue to talk about them in this presidential campaign and commit to doing something to fix them.
We see how Providence Mayor Jorge Lorza is signaling his intention to look for more money from nonprofit institutions like hospitals and universities, more money from labor unions and retirees. These are very difficult things to do. Do you believe that he's going to be successful in taking the steps necessary to put Providence on a better fiscal footing?
Well, you know, being the mayor of a city is a difficult job, and what Mayor Laws commissioned in this most recent study is, you know, what are the range of options we can do? You know, this is not magic. You know, every year you have to generate more money, you have to cut expenses, you have to figure out how you get through a budget process. And interestingly, there are a range of choices which come up every year, you know, more money from the nonprofits, more money from the state, raise taxes, cut services. So the mayor, I know, and his team will assess all these options. Asking for concessions from unions is always part of that discussion. And my guess is that they will cobble together some set of those choices that will get them through the budget year. And that's sort of the challenge of being a mayor. And I think none of these will be easy, but I have confidence that he'll be able to do it.
Is putting bankruptcy on the table really a smart idea? We've seen everybody from Alan Hassenfeld to a lot of fringe Republican folks like Dr. Harrop talk about it. Does that make any sense at all?
No. Look, I think, you know, the implications for cities or states to filing bankruptcy are severe. And so Look, I think, you know, lots of times people will use that language in negotiating. Read Ed Rendell's book, you know, A Prayer for the City, Buzz Bissinger's book that talked about what they did in Philadelphia. It was really about a way to, and persuading people to make concessions to do what you need to do to get through it. But I think everyone recognizes that would be a last resort, that sort of action, because it has implications for the long term.
Have you been on a picket line yet with the Verizon workers?
Yes.
You have almost $700,000 in your campaign war chest, according to your most recent filing. We know that congressional incumbents get reelected at a rate of better than 90%. Is it really fair that you enjoy that kind of financial advantage?
Well, look, people contribute to my reelection because they believe in the work that I'm doing, and I'm grateful for that. That's unfortunately under our current system part of what you have to do, raise money for re-election. I'm proud to be a co-sponsor of about six bills that are intended to really design a whole new campaign finance system so that that will not be the case. But I'm proud of the fact that I have support from Rhode Islanders all across our state who believe in the work that I'm doing strongly enough to contribute to provide financial support in my reelection. I'm grateful for that.
Congressman Donald Trump has emerged from the Republican side as the very likely nominee. What concerns you about his appeal?
Well, I mean, I think in many ways, Donald Trump is appealing to the real base of the Republican Party and to, I think, frankly, some of the worst parts of the party. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a number of Republicans who are running away from the candidacy of Donald Trump because it doesn't represent what they view as the values of the Republican Party. They're in the middle of a civil war between kind of traditional Republicans who had very different views on many of the issues Mr. Trump is speaking about and a candidate who sort of has his own ideology, Trump in a way. And so I think I would be very concerned if that those views became the views of the Republican Party, because I think it would lead to the disintegration of the Republican Party. And I think we benefit from having a two-party system in this country where we have opposition and we have opposing views and the ability to really vet ideas. And so I'm very concerned that it's leading to the disintegration of the Republican Party. I think the benefit of it will be, hopefully, the resurgence of a new Republican Party that is more responsive to the needs of the American people, that could be a real partner with Democrats in moving our country forward.
You mean it's more moderate?
Yes.
We're almost out of time here, but I'd like to go to foreign policy and ask about the U.S.-Iran nuclear agreement. You were a late supporter of that, supporting it after Senators Reid and Whitehouse. Why was your support coming in at that time, and how do you think the agreement is working out?
I've struggled with this a lot, reached out to a number of experts around the country to provide me with some analysis. I studied this for a very long time. This was a very close question for me. But I do want to say that the agreement appears to be working. The Iranians are, in fact, complying with the provisions of the agreement. Although, as many people suspected, they're complying with the provisions in the JCPOA, but not doing anything else right. They're engaged in lots of the Iran deal, the joint plan of action. But they've engaged in a lot of bad behavior around the region. They're engaged in places all around the world. They are doing ballistic missile testing. So on the one hand, the good news is they're complying with this. And I think we have for sure expanded the breakout time to a full year, which is very important to have a non-nuclear Iran. We also now have to push back hard in the other areas where they're engaged in terrorism and human rights violations and really trying to assert themselves in the region as a predominant power. So the good news is they don't have a nuclear weapon and they're not going to have one, but now we have a responsibility to push back hard against them in other parts and the destabilizing activities that they're engaged in.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Great to be here.
And Congressman David Cicilline.
Thank you for having me.